Okay, so welcome to our TV audience, to the Android Apps with Java seminar. This is not just for students who've received Android phones, but if you happen to have one of your own, you can follow along. There's nothing particularly special about the phones that we've handed out versus any phone you might get at the store. So, yeah, and also I'll state now that if you have any questions, since I would imagine more people are going to be watching this on TV than are going to be asking questions here, feel free to email them to me or let me know and we can meet and talk about your project. I'd be happy to advise anyone who's going to do an Android project. Oh, so my name is Kent Rakett, by the way, and I'll put my email address up at the end for anyone who wants to contact me. But I'm also, my email address is also on the website. So anyway, Android apps, how do they work? So Android apps are written in Java, and you may be familiar with the Java programming language if you've done it before at all, or perhaps not, but Java is very similar to C for those who don't know Java. The main difference between Java and C is that Java is an object-oriented programming language, which makes it a lot more powerful for creating kind of full-fledged applications that aren't just going to run in, you know, a little console box on, you know, NICE or on the cloud. We'll be getting into object-oriented programming a little bit this week in the course when we talk about JavaScript. So if you have particular questions about that, you can ask them in your section this week. But even if not, you should find it pretty easy to pick up just by looking at some demos. So I'm not going to be able to talk about object-oriented programming in particular today, but you should be able to learn about it from various tutorials online or, like I said, this week. So more specifically, I'm not going to go through the setup of Android today. It's kind of an involved process. It'll take you probably about 30 minutes to an hour, depending on how fast you can download all this stuff. But this is a series of tools that you'll probably want to use when you begin to develop Android applications. So first of all, we have the Android SDK, which is an absolute requirement. You can get that from the Android website, from Google's website. The link is, as it says on the slide. The next thing you'll probably want to install that isn't completely necessary is Eclipse. If you haven't used Eclipse, it's an IDE, or Integrated Development Environment, which basically gives you a text editor with a lot of features that are useful for programming. So for example, it can do syntax highlighting for you, much in the way that, you know, Vim and Emacs do. And it can also do things like code completion, like figure out, you know, what variable you were planning on typing, and you can just hit tab to finish it. And Eclipse also includes a very good debugger. So if you have experience using GDB, you can do that in Eclipse as well, but with more graphics. And I'll do a demo of that a little bit later on. The third thing you'll need is ADT for Eclipse, if you're using Eclipse. Those are the Android development tools that kind of hook into Eclipse and specialize the development environment for using Android. And they're extremely handy. So if you use Eclipse, you're definitely going to want to use these. And then the last thing you're going to want to do once you have all this stuff downloaded and set up is you're going to want to run this command to create an Android virtual device, which is a really fancy name for basically an emulator. So what that's going to allow you to do is, without actually installing stuff on your phone, which could take a while, you can simply install it onto the emulator. And I'll go over how to do that in a moment. And you can debug it right on your machine without needing to kind of fiddle with the phone while you're trying to do work. So as it happens, even if you didn't win the lottery and get an actual phone, if you'd like to try developing an Android app anyway, you can do it this way using the emulator. It's completely the same experience as using the actual phone, with the major difference being that, you know, you can't actually carry it around with you. So any preliminary questions before moving on? Okay. So when we talk about Android apps, there's some special vocabulary that we're going to have to use. So I'll go over briefly what each of these words mean, because I'll be using them regularly. And then I'll go into more detail as to what each one of these things is and how it affects Android app development, how it relates. So the first important term is activity. An activity is one visual aspect of an application. That is to say, if you had, for example, a text messaging application, one activity would be the activity in which you select the recipient or select an ongoing conversation. And then presumably selecting something like that would pop up a text editor, which you could use to then type your message, which would be another activity. So an activity is basically kind of one unit of interaction with the user. In order to actually make activities display on the screen, you have to use something called a view, which we'll also get into later. And finally, there can only be one activity in the foreground at a time. On the other hand, we have services, which are kind of like the counterpart to activities. Services are things things that run in the background, processes that run in the background and don't require any user interaction whatsoever to keep going. They can't be displayed with a view. The only way the user can interact with a service directly is if there's an activity which hooks into that service. So activities and services together kind of give you both foreground processes and background processes. And then the last thing would be events. I'll get into what events and event-driven programming is later. But basically, events are things, actions to which an application can respond. And that would include, say, tapping on the screen or pushing a button or typing something on the keyboard. So any vocabulary questions? OK. So what are activities, first of all? The activity is going to be the thing you're working with most often when you develop Android applications. Especially if you're programming a game or something like that, you're really going to be focusing on the main activity of the application. So what is an activity? As I said, it's something which presents and manages the user interface for one specific task associated with your application. Android is somewhat limited compared to an operating system like, say, Windows or Mac OS or even Linux, in that only one activity can be in the foreground at a time. And only activities that are in the foreground can be doing work. So that is, when one activity is put into the background, it ceases to execute. And whatever activity replaced it is allowed to begin executing its code. Now, this would seem to be very limiting, but activities can interact with each other in a variety of different ways, which allow them to collectively do everything you might want to do. So in my previous example with the text messaging application, once you selected a recipient, then the recipient selector activity would launch a new activity, which would allow you to actually type the message, which would put the selection activity back in the background so you can no longer interact with it. But you wouldn't want to interact with it anyway, because at that point, presumably, you want to begin typing your message. And once that message typing activity was finished, it would go into the background, and the recipient selection activity would come back into the foreground, or maybe some other activity that you specified. But the idea is that activities within an individual application can pass control back and forth so that you have control over what's executing in the foreground, even though that can only be one thing at a time. So there's a chart called the activity lifecycle, which defines how activities behave as processes are put into the foreground and come into the background, and how the activity is supposed to respond to that. So that looks like this. It's a bit small on the slide, but I'll kind of go through it from top to bottom and explain what it is. So in order to understand how activities work, you really need to have a good sense of this chart, or at least have it close at hand so you can refer to it from time to time. So this is a flow chart which starts with the activity being launched at the top and the activity being shut down at the bottom. And remember that activities aren't necessarily an entire application. So this can be happening multiple times within just one instance of your actual program. So the first thing that happens when an activity starts is that this onCreate function is called. And ordinarily, you'll use that to initialize whatever kind of stuff you need for your program to run. A good thing that you would initialize in onCreate, for example, would be probably the view that actually displays your application or displays this activity. After that, the onStart function is called. Then the onResume function is called. And why it calls three things in a row at the beginning, I'll explain in a moment. And then once all three of those functions are done, your activity is considered to be running. So it'll be displayed to the user, and the user can interact with it once all three of those things have been called. Now, at this point, you probably can't read it, but it says another activity comes in front of the activity. So this can happen for any number of reasons. Your user could have pressed the home key and just gotten out of your program completely, or something could have popped up from some kind of service which would take focus away from your activity, or your activity could have manually passed control away. But either way, the original activity is no longer running. So what happens in that case? First of all, this onPause function will be called. And onPause is an opportunity for your application to kind of save what it was doing before it loses control completely. So before anything else is allowed to come in front, your activity is allowed to respond to the fact that it's going to be going into the background by calling onPause. And then this puts the application into a state which is known as paused. From there, we can go three different ways. Android manages memory dynamically, and it doesn't really ask the user very much about what the user wants to do with memory, which makes sense for a cell phone. But the consequence of this is that every now and then, a paused activity may be killed if your phone runs out of memory. And it doesn't have that much of it. So if you're doing heavy-duty web browsing, you'll probably find that any other applications you had in the background will be killed if you try to go back to them and use them again. So in this case, the process will be killed, and the next time it runs, we'll have to start over from the beginning on onCreate. The next thing that can happen is the activity can be put back into the foreground. So if, for example, just some kind of notification window were to pop up and the user were to respond to it with cancel or OK or something, and your activity came right back, then you'd hit on resume. And your activity would once again be running after on resume finished. So now you begin to see the consequence of, or the reason for having these three functions all in a row. When one of these is called, your application knows just how deep, or just how far away from being the active activity it was. And then the last thing that happens is that the activity can disappear entirely from the screen. So if, for example, the new activity you created were to be a full screen window, or again, the example of the home key being pressed, then this onStop function will be called. And then the things that can happen from onStop are the same as the things that can happen from the pause state. And then finally, if your application is ever shut down, onDestroy will be called. But onDestroy isn't necessarily called if it's killed for memory. So onDestroy isn't very safe to use to save state. So that was a long explanation, and it's kind of a confusing flowchart, but fortunately you don't have to memorize it, because you'll have it at hand either on this slide or on Google's website. It's from the documentation. And the important thing to remember is just that because of the way Android manages memory, your activity can be stopped in a wide variety of different ways. You need to be prepared to handle that. So you can't count on it being shut down in the normal way. And most Android activity life cycles won't be similar to programming you've done in this class up to this point, where you ran the program and it did something and then it returned zero from main and you were done. So that's the main takeaway here. And how exactly you deal with all these different states you can be in is something I'll go into in a moment. So any questions on this before I move on to views? Okay. So the next important aspect of Android applications are views. And views have a very close correspondence with activities. So on a basic level, views are hierarchical organizations of UI elements. And if you look at the chart on the right, you notice that we can have these view group objects, which have as their children either views or view groups. Now, view is kind of a misleading name because it implies that it's kind of a full screen picture. But in fact, a view can be any kind of element which is drawn to the screen. So a view can be a button, it can be a text box, it can be a picture, it can be a label, any number of things like that all constitute a view. And view groups are just collections of view objects that can organize them in different ways on the screen. So you can organize them kind of in a grid fashion, you can organize them into a list, you can organize them just kind of horizontally side to side. So view groups basically allow you to define how these things are positioned on the screen. And activities basically say that they want to use a certain view, and then that view will be responsible for drawing the views beneath it. The takeaway from that being that things nearer the bottom will be drawn on top of things that are before them. So you have to think a little bit about how to structure things such that, for example, you don't end up with a background picture on top of a button, which would obviously be problematic. The last thing to remember about views would probably be that there's two ways to define them, either programmatically or in XML. And I'll show you examples of both methods in a moment. But so the XML that you learned, or that you will learn doing this problem set, and that you may have dabbled with on the previous problem set, will come in handy when working with Android views. Yes?
Are view groups views as well?
Yes.
What was the question?
Oh, sorry. The question is whether view groups are also considered views. And they are. So, like I said, view groups can have as their children any view, and view groups are considered also to be views for that purpose. So when a view group is rendered, it'll render all of its children, both any view group children it has and any specific view children it has. So what that means in English is that if, for example, you wanted to nest, say, a view group that put one thing on top of, that put things in vertical arrangement, and then in each one of those vertical arrangements you wanted to have another view group that arranged things horizontally, so you had kind of like a table structure, then you'd be able to do that. Any other questions? Okay. So the next thing to talk about would be services. Because of the way that the activity lifecycle works, you can't really guarantee that any given activity will run consistently for as long as you want it to, which can be problematic. That is to say, if you want an activity that would play music, for example, you obviously don't want to have to be looking at the music playing application all the time that you're playing the music, but if you were to navigate away from that activity, then as we saw before, the OS could spontaneously kill it for memory, and then the music would stop playing and you'd probably be pretty annoyed. So services are a way to get around this. Services are basically special processes that do work in the background and are not associated with any particular user interface. So services don't have to have a view that, with which they display themselves. So combined with activities, services give you all the typical power of, you know, a modern operating system, where you can have things that are running in the foreground and interacting with the user, and things that are running in the background, independent of what else is going on in the operating system, and doing something like playing music or watching for changes in your GPS location or things like that. So services are ordinarily independent of any applications that you may be running specifically, but applications can also bind with services to interact with them. So in the previous example of the music player, you probably have an activity that represented the front end of the music player, and that front end would bind to the service in order to tell it what file it should be playing or what volume it should be playing the file at. And then once you navigate away from the front end, it can be killed by the operating system for memory, or anything can happen to it. But the changes it made to the state of the service itself will be persistent. So by combining these two things, you can effectively get a full-fledged application which can run in the background. And of course, also, when this activity would be then started back up, it could ask the service for whatever data it needed. So it could ask the service what song is playing, what volume was it playing at, and then it can initialize all of its own state to match what the service says, which is a pretty powerful combination. So any questions about services?
Yeah. Are there any tools or any design patterns you should use to minimize your energy use? If you're just blindly writing a service, then you could keep the CPU on all of the time, which would be really bad for your battery. So is there anything that you could do to minimize that?
So the question we have is, how does services kind of, given that we're dealing with cell phones here and a mobile OS, how do we make sure that services running in the background aren't just eating up battery constantly? The typical way you would do that is, if you're dealing with like a music player application, there's really nothing you can do, because that's going to need to be consistently, you know, reading from storage and playing music and so on. But if you have, say, a service which is checking regularly for email or something like that, the ordinary way you would want to set that up is with some kind of timer, which would say that the service should do this thing, you know, once per hour or something like that. And you can actually see that in a lot of the applications that come preloaded with your phone, like the email application, you can set how often it checks. And by using that, essentially the service will go to sleep in between these periods when it's actually supposed to be doing something, and it won't really use up any battery during that time, you know, beyond kind of whatever is needed for the operating system to check whether it's time or not. So usually timing is the best way to make sure that services aren't eating up a lot of battery. The other thing that services can do is, as we'll get into in a moment, services can listen for specific events. So basically the service can be dormant until the operating system says to it, hey, this event just happened. And then the service can wake up and respond to that event and otherwise not be doing anything. So then the only overhead associated with the service would be the overhead associated with the OS listening for the event, which is what it's going to be doing anyway. So I would say those are the main two ways to deal with that. That's a good question, though. So if the takeaway from this is that if you write a service right off the bat, you might find that your phone dies really fast. And if you see that, this is the reason why. The fact that services aren't deactivated like activities are when your phone goes off. Okay. So as I've been alluding to several times, Android is an event-driven operating system. What that means is that when you interact with the operating system, your interaction is translated into events by the operating system itself on a low level. So a tap on a specific location in the screen would be translated into a tap event containing the data of where you tapped. And that also holds for pressing buttons or typing on the keyboard or whatever. The active activity can listen for certain events, and it can also choose not to listen to other events. And events which are being listened to by the active activity will be passed to it as basically an event object, which contains two pieces of data. First of all, you'll know what kind of event it is. So obviously, if you're listening for both a key press and a button press, you'll want to know which one it is, because you'll probably want to handle them differently. The other aspect of an event which will be passed into the activity is metadata associated with that event. So the previous example was the location on the screen that was tapped. If it's a keyboard key, it would be the actual key that was pressed. And then your activity can do things based on that metadata. So for example, you know that maybe if this location on the screen is tapped, then you want to take this action. Whereas if this location was tapped, you don't want to do anything, or something like that. And obviously with typing, you know, if you were had a game, for example, the S key might be to start, and the R key might be to restart, and the Q key might be to quit. All of which you would want to be able to separate. So basic questions on that. As it turns out, you can also do event-driven programming in C. You saw it when we did ncurses, where there was kind of a very primitive, when we did Sudoku, where there was a primitive event handling loop, which kind of watched for keyboard key presses as its only input. But there's many other events that can be given once you have a full-fledged OS with like a user interface and not just a console interface. So once you have all of these things down, then you're probably going to want to know how to deal with the way Android processes begin and end. So you'd probably be kind of upset if you were in the middle of typing an email and then a message popped up that told you about something, or you know, you wanted to Google search something for the purposes of, you know, clarifying something in your email, and you came back to the email application, your email was gone. That would be very upsetting. And with a cell phone, no one has the time to sit there and like look for a menu and click File, Save before exiting the application. So to make up for the way that Android can kind of spontaneously kill processes without you knowing about it, there's this saving state and restoring state idiom present in every activity you might want to write. And you can use this so that when an activity is stopped and started, it can retain its state in between those two actions. And here's basically how it works. So the onCreate method can be passed sort of a bundle. And all of a bundle is it's kind of like a struct in C. It's just a chunk of stuff. And the advantage of a bundle versus a struct is that whereas beforehand you would have to say what everything in the struct is, a bundle can be dynamically allocated. So you know, you can just say that this particular bundle has a string in it and an int in it and an int in it. And you don't have to declare that beforehand anywhere. So you get to put anything you want into it, which is very powerful. Bundles, for those who have done Java before, are basically map objects, which are just, again, like these structs that can contain various types of things. And by using onCreate and onResume to look at this bundle that's associated with those two events, you can check whether, for example, if you're in onCreate, you can check whether, if you're in onCreate or onResume, you can check whether onPause saved any data into whatever bundle is associated with your application. And then on the next invocation of the program, onCreate and onResume will be able to see that state and load it into the program before it's ever displayed, which gives the impression that the program was never killed to begin with, even though it may actually have been. So any questions about that? So all the applications, or the vast majority at least, that come on your phone by default have this implemented to a very high level, which means that you might think that your phone has never killed a process for you before automatically. But in fact, it is happening all the time behind the scenes, and they're just so good at saving their state that when you come back to that application and it loads everything up, you never notice that it was gone, which is also what you should aim for in writing your application, or else the users will probably get annoyed. So finally, a word on debugging. I mentioned earlier that Eclipse has a very good debugger as part of it. Now, you don't have to use Eclipse, but this debugger is so powerful that I would say this is the primary reason, besides being able to work in a text editor on your own operating system and, you know, not just in Notepad or something, and beyond the syntax highlighting and all that stuff. This debugger gives you the ability to, on a very low level, pinpoint exactly what's wrong with your program, and it's much more convenient than GDB because you have, you know, a fancy user interface that can display a lot of data at once. So the way the debugger works, basically, is that if you happen to get a force close, which is the Android equivalent of a seg fault, when you're running your program, then you can set a breakpoint around where you expect the force close occurred. And in fact, if you run the program in the emulator, I think it'll actually bounce straight back to Eclipse automatically and tell you exactly where the error occurred. And then you can use the features of Eclipse that include listing all the variables that are in scope at the time and typing in watch expressions. So that is to say, if I were to evaluate this expression at this point in the code, what would it be equal to? And then you can find out things like, oh, this object was null, but it shouldn't have been. I forgot to initialize it. Or things like, I passed a bad value. You know, I shouldn't have passed a negative value here, but I did. And that caused the application to quit. So this basically allows you to fix problems really fast. And it's one of the most powerful features of Eclipse. So I'm going to demo that at the end. Any questions about debugging, I guess? All right, so for the kind of the last third of this, there's a couple projects that I thought I would show you. I considered writing my own, but since the documentation is really good for the sample projects Google provides, I decided to go with their projects instead. So the projects we're going to look at are, first of all, a Hello World application, which, as you probably remember from the first week of CS50, is traditionally the first thing you do in any operating system. Anytime you write a new program in a new language. And the next thing we're going to look at is an implementation of the traditional Snake video game, which you've probably seen before, or maybe you haven't. You don't have to understand everything right off the bat, and you probably won't, but I'm going to try to highlight some of the features in each of these programs that correspond to what I've been talking about up to now. So let's see. I guess before I get to that, any overall questions on Android in general?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different Android phones compared to like the iPhone. So what do you have to, what other things do you have to take into account that may change down the road?
That's a great point. So the question is, given the fact that unlike how there's one iPhone with one set of specifications generally, there's a whole lot of different Android phones being released by a bunch of different companies with a bunch of different specs. And how do you deal with writing an application that's robust across all these different things? So basically the way you would do that is you can use a variety of methods. I'm not sure I'll go into it today because I don't think they're exhibited in our sample code, but you can use a variety of methods to get information about the phone from the operating system. So for example, you can find out how big the screen is. You can find out what kind of capabilities it has as far as Bluetooth goes or Wi-Fi goes or things like that. And by asking the phone about those things, you can have your application respond to that information. So for example, you might create a view for phones that have the traditional, 320 by 480 screen, I think. And then you might have a separate view, which is for phones with bigger screens that can display more data. And then once you've asked the operating system what kind of phone it is, then you can use one view or the other, would be one example. So basically, you want to, instead of hard-coding numbers into your code that assume things about the phone, you want to ask the operating system those questions first. But for the purposes of this class, I wouldn't worry about portability. If you're doing your final project in Android, I wouldn't worry about portability too much. Make sure it works on the phones you were given, and kind of the default phone, because it can kind of be, given how many different Android phones exist, making sure it works on all of them can be really difficult. And since you don't have those phones to test on, that would be another obstacle. So don't worry about it too much for this class. Any other questions? OK. So to look at some code. So first of all, a quick tour around the Eclipse application. That's what I have open here. I hope everyone can see this. So I apologize if this is difficult to read. But again, I'll include links to where you can get this code from Google at the end of the slides. So you can follow along on your own computer. You can pause the video at this point, download it, and then come back and follow along. So this is Eclipse. Eclipse has a very busy interface and is often criticized for that. But once you learn your way around it, it's actually pretty easy to work with. So I'll kind of go through it clockwise or something, and then we'll talk about the code itself. So the first thing in Eclipse you have on the left half over here is a list of open projects. And within each open project you have, you can have kind of any number of subfolders that contain code or contain other resources associated with your project. So over here, if you want to open, say, a file that wasn't open before, you just find it on the left half, and you can double-click it, and it'll open up. Across the top here, we have a list of tabs. So it's kind of like tab browsing. Eclipse is a tabbed IDE, so you can have multiple files open at once. And this is really convenient. Over here on the right, we have a task list. You probably won't need that for the moment. Sorry, it's on the right half of the screen. Yeah. And then right below that is outline. And the outline is a look at what the code looks like in a hierarchical way. So this is really cool. You can see in each individual class how many functions there are, what the functions are called. And then you can further expand those functions to see, you know, if they have any other sub-levels to them. So an example would be in this program. We can see that the Snake class has these two variables over here. And then it also has these three functions. And you can see what their return types are and what they expect to be called with, which is cool. And then finally, down here at the bottom, there's a bunch of other useful tabs. The first one is this problems tab. So as you're probably familiar with, when you run GCC, it outputs a bunch of errors at the command line. If there's errors in your code when you try to run it via Eclipse, then the problems appear down here with the description in this box, and then it'll show you the line number over here. And you can also use this console tab down here to get kind of the GDB experience with line by line what's going on. And then, of course, in the center is where your code appears. So any Eclipse questions? The Eclipse documentation is pretty good, but if you have any questions about something you'd like to do but can't, you can ask me. And it's also completely customizable, so you can move the stuff around if you like. But this is what the default interface would look like if you were to install it fresh. Okay, so the first activity we're going to look at is, the first program is this hello activity. So actually, I'm going to delete the project briefly so that you can see what it looks like to add a new project in. So if you have this source code downloaded, you can go to New Android Project, which will appear here, assuming you did all the installation steps we went through before. Then you can pick Create Project from Existing Source, and then you browse to where that application should be. So in this case, under the SDK, it should be under Platforms, Android 1.6, then Samples, and then Hello Activity. So you can pick that directory that the sample code exists in, and all this stuff below will be filled in automatically for you. So you can get started with one of these sample applications very quickly without needing to know what all these options are. And then you can just click Finish down here, and Eclipse will include the application. You may have to do if you go up to the top and look at the project menu, you may have to do a clean so that it properly kind of incorporates all the elements when you create the project, because every now and then it messes up. Eclipse has a few glitches in it of that nature. So anyway, once that's done, you'll see that below the hello activity, there's a variety of different subfolders. And to kind of go through what each of these folders means, we have, first of all, Android 1.6. That's just the Android library. You don't need to worry about that. After that, that is SRC, which is the source code for your program. So this is where you'll be doing most of your work. We see there's a helloactivity.java file. And then this is, as you can see, our source code. So after source, you have gen, which isn't something you'll need to look at. And then below that, just some various other things like resources and tests, which you won't need to work with too much. Resources is interesting for a reason we'll get to in a moment. But for now, the main takeaway is you should be doing most of your work in source. And the other folders are going to appear, but you don't need to worry about them too much. So before we start looking at actual Java, any questions about that? All right. So I'm not going to go over all the aspects of Java and, you know, what we're importing and things like that, but I am going to show you kind of what the bare bones Android application looks like. So the basic aspect that any application has to have is this chunk here. You have to have an activity class, which extends the base activity class. And then in order for your activity to actually do anything, you need to have this function onCreate, which I mentioned before. So if you think back to the flow chart, onCreate is the first function that's called when an application, or rather when an activity, is instantiated. And as I said, it's called with this bundle saved instance state, which in this case isn't used. And then finally, because as we recall, activities have to be associated with views, this setContentView function is called. And then it takes this object here, which as it turns out is a view. So I mentioned before that views can be specified either programmatically or in XML files. And in this case, as the comment suggests, this is one that was specified in an XML file. So this hello activity name is actually the ID of the XML tag that represents this particular view. So that's why we have this hello activity name. And this is all initialized by the base activity code. So that's why we don't have to do it ourselves. If you look at that XML file in Eclipse, that's over to the left here under the res folder, which stands for resources, and then under layout. So we'll open helloactivity.xml. And we get this preview in Eclipse of what it's going to look like. So what's basically happening here is that Eclipse is looking at the XML file, and because of the tools that are installed when you install all the Android plugins, it can actually render a reasonable reproduction of what it's actually going to look like on the screen. So this is one advantage of doing things using XML as opposed to doing them programmatically. Down here at the bottom, if you look at the properties window, all of this list of properties corresponds to things which can be set in the XML. things which actually have values to them are things that are set, and then blank ones are things that aren't specified at all. So those will be the default. So we'll come back to this in a moment to see how we can play around with the view. But for now, let's try running this project. So there's this green arrow button at the top, which represents run. We can click, and we can run the project by clicking this. It'll ask us run as. We want Android application. And then we see it switches to the console here at the bottom, and it's installing the APK. So if we open up our emulator, then we see we get the activity as expected. And the emulator will actually be launched automatically if you set everything up the way I said at the very beginning. So you don't have to launch this program yourself. I happen to have it already open, but it'll be opened up by Eclipse if it needs to be. And we notice that we can interact with the emulator by typing or clicking to represent taps. So this is our Hello World application. Any questions so far as to how we got here? Okay. Now, to come back to that XML bit, we know that the view is specified within the XML in Eclipse. And by using Eclipse's properties editor down here, we can actually change how this is going to look. So let's say we think the text is too small at the moment, and we want to make it bigger. Then we can scroll all the way down until we see text size. Notice that there's tons and tons of possible properties, which are all defined on the Google documentation. And finally, we see the text size is 18. So we can try blowing that up by changing it to, I don't know, let's say 28. Then we will save this file. And we'll rebuild the project. So once again, same process. We run. It says it's going to install it. And I can't tell if it gave up or not. I'll try that again. Eclipse can be somewhat buggy sometimes. There we go. And we notice that the text has indeed become bigger. So by editing the XML, you can either edit it in a manual text editor, or you can use the nifty plugin to Eclipse like I just showed you. You can affect how things show up within views. And this keeps a good separation between the presentation of the view in your application and the actual code that's used to run your application. So the XML strategy tends to be good. So that's how we can kind of play around with the Hello World application. Another thing we might try doing is testing out the debugger. So the way the debugger works in Eclipse is like this. You'll notice that to the left of lines of code, you have kind of this sidebar, which is currently highlighted in blue. If you right-click on that sidebar, you can get this context menu which says toggle breakpoint. And if you do that, it'll put this little blue circle in to indicate that you have a breakpoint. And then if you want to try debugging the application, at the top before we were using the green arrow to run, and now we're going to use the little bug icon to try debugging. So we once again pick Android application. It will start the application on the device. It'll tell us that it's waiting for the debugger for a moment. And now Eclipse will go into the debug view, which is a view optimized with the windows in slightly different locations to allow you to debug. So you notice here, first of all, in the code section, that the line that we halted on is highlighted in green. And this works just like setting a breakpoint in GDB. It'll pause right before executing this line. Up here at the top, if we can pan up a little bit, you'll see that we have a backtrace, which will tell us what functions were called in order to get here. You don't really need to know what this means, because most of these functions will have been called by the operating system in order to initialize your application. But we know that we're in onCreate, since it's the thing at the very top. And then finally, very conveniently, on the right side, you'll see that we have a list of variables, which are currently in scope. So we can look at, for example, saved instance state, which is something that's passed into onCreate as a parameter, and we'll see here that it's null. So if, for example, we were trying to use in this program saved instance state and we got a force close, we didn't know why, then this is the kind of thing you might want to look at. Like you say, oh, I expected there to be a saved instance state, but in fact it was null. I should have checked that first, just as an example. So these are the types of things you can do in the debugger. And what's happening in the debugger has a correspondence one-to-one with what's going on in your emulator as you test. So you can have the debugger open in one window and the emulator open in another, and step through and see how the emulator's display changes every time. So for the moment, we'll go back to the traditional view. So I think I want to stop this. Oh well. Okay. So that's basically the anatomy of your most basic Android application and how you would interact with it in Eclipse. So any questions about that before we move on to a more difficult example? All right. So presumably you're going to want to move beyond just doing silly hello world applications. If you want to program a game or something like that, there's a pretty good example called Snake, which is present in, again, the sample code. And you can put it into your Eclipse in exactly the same way. So the Snake code is pretty complicated. It has three different files, one of which represents just the basic snake activity, shown here. And then there's also two files called snake view and tile view, which I'll show you in a moment, which deal with all the drawing. So what I want to do is kind of highlight the specific parts of the snake activity which correspond to the parts that we learned about, and then kind of demonstrate how you can expand just the simple hello world application into this complicated snake game. So let's look at how onCreate works in this program. We see, first of all, that we have a bunch more going on just in onCreate. So remember that this is what happens anytime this program is started from a state where it was not running before, as in it was started cold. We see, first of all, that we still have set content view, which is something that we had before. But now we have to deal with these other portions of the view as well. And the way these work is that we look at the ID that we specified in our XML and use the findViewById function to get a handle to that view in the Java. So this might be a little advanced if you haven't used Java before, but please bear with me, and I think you'll get the hang of it as you write your own applications. And then once we've gotten handles to these things, we can manipulate them programmatically, as we have here, setTextView, for example, based on the view that we grabbed from our XML using findViewById. Down here is kind of interesting. I talked before about how you could use save instance state in order to pass state in between different instances of the program so that your user never notices whether it was killed or not. That's what's happening here. So our hello world application didn't need to do this because it didn't need to save any state because it didn't do anything. But presumably, if you have to quit playing Snake briefly because, you know, class starts or something, or you get off the shuttle, you're going to want the game to be where it was before. And that's how save instance state works here. So if it's null, that means we're launched fresh, and there's nothing to restore. So we're just going to set our own mode to ready. But if we're being restored, then we're going to use this map object that I talked about before and grab it from the bundle, which is inside the saved instance state, which is very technical, but it basically means we're going to get the data which saved our state from the saved state object, which was passed into us when we called onCreate. And then you don't need to worry about what this key is. It's just a unique identifier that distinguishes this bundle from other bundles. And then we just call some other functions, which are kind of black boxes as far as we're concerned, where we can restore the state of the map, so the position of where the snake was and where the apples were and so on. And then we'll put the game into a paused mode so the user doesn't just have to start playing as soon as they hit the program, but they can unpause at their leisure. So this function, again, this is all just an onCreate, corresponds to the simple onCreate we had before for hello world, and just does a lot more work of the type that you would ordinarily want to do when your program is initialized. So when you write a real program, if you do this for your project, then something like this will probably correspond more to what your own onCreate will look like than the hello world example, which didn't really do anything. So I think I'll go over the view very briefly and look at some event handling in a moment, but any questions before we get there? Great. So let's look at the snake view, which is set off in its own file. It doesn't have to be in its own file, but when you're writing Java, it's good to split things up into different files so that you don't end up with one big file with everything cluttered in it. So in this case, the view, which represents our game, is in this snakeview.java file. Now, this file is enormous, and we're not going to be able to look at all of it. I think if you read over it yourself, you should understand fairly easily what's going on once you kind of stare at it for a moment. And a lot of the work it does is just special drawing tasks to deal with the graphics of the snake game. So we're not going to worry about that. But what I do want to look at is some of the event handling. So if we scroll down a ways until we find it. Here we are. We have here the onKeyDown function. And any function that begins with the word on is usually going to be an event that occurs on that specific action. So as you can see from the comment, this handles key events in the game. And in this case, it allows you to control the direction in which the snake is traveling. So we see that, when I said before, events generally have two pieces of data associated with them. We have, first of all, this message, which is the event itself. And then we have this other piece of metadata, which is the key code, which represents which key was pressed. So let's look at what happens when a key is pressed in this game. This should perhaps remind you of what Sudoku looked like. We're testing key code, which is like C, the character that the user input, against various constants, which represent the value of different keys that can be pressed on the keyboard. And then based on what key was pressed, so for example, this whole block here represents what happens if it's up, then we know that up is, for example, apparently a special code which will initialize a new game if the game was over. So if we're in ready or lose, then we want to initialize a new game. Or if we were in pause down here, then we want to just set ourselves to running. If we were facing not south, i.e. we were traveling left, right, or up, then we're going to set our direction to be up, and then we'll be done. And then we'll see below here that we also handle the down key, we handle the left key, and so on. The final aspect to note about event handling is that when you actually handle an event and do something with it as yourself, that is, you use the event, then usually you should return true, which represents, yes, I used the event. I chose to do something with it. And that tells the operating system that the operating system doesn't have to do anything else with that event. It can just toss it away. Sometimes you may want to return false. There may be a special case in which you'll say, oh no, you know, I don't want to handle this key being pressed. This has nothing to do with me. So you'll deal with it, operating system. And the operating system will continue to do whatever else it would do with that event that it would ordinarily do. So an example of something like this is you might want the home key in your game not to go home. So you would handle a key press of the home key, and then you would return true to say to the operating system, no, 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 don't keep handling this. Don't go to the home screen. I handled this. It's taken care of. Because otherwise, if you return false in that case, then the operating system will continue to work with the home key event. And of course, by default, the home key event will take you out of your game, and that will be really inconvenient. From there, basically, everything is reasonably straightforward. We just handle a variety of other different keys, and we see that they do exactly what you would expect in a snake game, much like in your Sudoku game. Let's see. I think that was the last aspect I wanted to talk about, but I will briefly run through the rest of the code and make sure there was nothing else interesting. Yep, the vast majority of this code is really just code that draws the board and deals with the actual aspects of the game. So although this code looks really complicated, it's actually just mostly code that deals with graphics, and the game itself is relatively simple. So I think this might be a good one to start with. If you want to get a feel for how a real application works. And you can also try playing this game in the emulator and setting breakpoints and stopping at various times to kind of see what each line of code is doing and how it affects what you see in the emulator, which is probably a good way to learn. So we're pretty much out of time for today. I know this was probably a really fast run through, and especially for those who aren't familiar with Java, may have been very confusing. But nonetheless, Java, once you've learned C, really isn't that difficult. So I think if you spend some time grinding away at it, you should get it. And I am also available via email, so I'll type that up so that you can see. So if you have any questions about this, you can either contact me or any of the other TFs who have phones and have been developing. So that address is... Actually, I think that address is for everyone who has phones. So I guess we don't have a mailing list just for TFs anymore. But the mailing list for people who have phones in general, both students and TFs, is androids@cs50.net. So you can feel free to use that mailing list to kind of discuss development and talk about problems you might be having. So I guess that's it, unless there's any questions at the end. All right, well, thanks for watching. And if you are one of the lucky few who has a phone, have fun. And I'm looking forward to seeing everyone's projects.